Chapter 9. Leaving the cursed city of Mousillon proved a much easier task than entering it had. No mobs of desperate, violent wretches roamed the haunted streets. No packs of hungry ghouls prowled the alleys. Even the armed patrols of Mousillon's decadent aristocrats seemed to be content to remain within the decaying castles of their masters. The city was as deserted as an open grave. Only the croaking of vultures and the scuttling creep of rats disturbed the sepulchral silence that hung over the place. The cause of such fear that even the degenerate inhabitants of a place like Mousillon hid behind locked doors was easily discovered. When the bounty hunters and their elf companion emerged from the dank sewage tunnel, Olgrin Baylax had discovered. The castle of Duke Merrimond was now just a pile of rubble, free of its outer walls, collapsed entirely, as though the fist of an angry god had smashed the fortress flat. The blighted districts of rotting houses and shops that had surrounded Merrimond's stronghold were blackened and charred, scarred by a flame intense enough to prosper even in the moldy, swamp-tainted wood that prevailed in these environs. Dark silhouettes of bodies littered the cobbles of the streets, the only reminder left of men struck down by the all-consuming flames. The bounty hunters had resisted Ithilwale's desperate, terrified insistence that Gabineau had called down the wrath of some ancient monster with the artifact she had called the Fell Fang. Then, confronted by the evidence of their own eyes, they had no choice but to believe her. But there was little time to consider the desolation and the awesome power that had caused it. Every moment that passed put more distance between the hunters and their prey, if indeed Gabineau had been fortunate enough to escape the doom he had summoned. The assumption of his death, however, was not something Ithilwale was prepared to allow, nor one the bounty hunters preferred, for if the man was dead, then he was either buried beneath the castle or one of the blackened lumps of slag, sprawled upon the streets. In either case, there would be nothing to take back to Caron for a reward. Though unchallenged in their passage through the streets, the trio of hunters were not alone. On occasion, a furtive shape might be seen picking through the ruins, desperate avarice overcoming the fear that gripped most of the city. Some of these fled at the approach of Brunner and his companions, others defiantly stood their ground, determined to protect whatever garbage they had discovered. The promise of a few copper coins, or a glowering threat rumbling from Olgrin's harsh mouth, bought information from these wretches. Some had seen the fall of Merrimond's fortress and described in exacting detail the horrific monster that had brought about such carnage. A few, at the prompting of Ithilwale, recalled the handsome rogue they had seen slinking away from the castle after the dragon had passed. They pointed with grimy fingers toward the south and the outer walls of the city. Brunner was not surprised. Freed from Merrimond's dungeons, there was nothing to keep their quarry in Mousillon any longer. Brunner insisted on checking every hovel and farmstead they came upon once they themselves were free of the city. He knew that a man like Gabineau would not remain without a horse for long. Learning how near to the city he had been able to steal one would give them some idea as to how much of a lead the outlaw had on them. It was also of little surprise that the bandit had stolen the first animal he had come upon, a miserable old plough horse that represented the only possession of worth for its grey-headed owner. Reaching the farm where Brunner had stabled his own horses and the dappled mule Olgrin rode, the bounty hunter paid 12 pieces of silver to secure a mare for Ithilwale, again earning a surly reminder from Olgrin that the elf would not be taking any part of his own share in the reward. It was not long before they were once again traveling the road leading south. Brunner was of the opinion that their nefarious quarry might be seeking refuge within one of the small pirate communities that could be found nuzzled amid the rocky shores of Aquitaine and Brionne. But the keen eyes of Ithilwale caused Brunner to reconsider his thoughts when, on their first day out of Mousillon, the elf detected a black spiral of smoke rising in the east.
"It could be anything,"
Olgrin snarled.
"Some damn fool peasant setting fire to his hut, or maybe some nobleman removing an unsightly wood from his domain."
"Or more likely the beast is on the prowl," Ithilwale replied, her tone sharp. The dwarf had baited her remorselessly throughout their journey, and even her patience was coming to an end.
"You think our friend might be there?" Brunner asked.
There was no question in his mind that Ithilwale had the right of it, that the smoke she saw was likely related to the dragon. The enchantress shook her head. "Perhaps, if he is fool enough to use the fell fang again," she replied. Brunner nodded, turning Fiend's head so that a horse began to head across a field that bordered the road. Olgrin noted the action, sputtering a protest.
"You can't simply ride off on this tall-eared harpy, say so,"
the dwarf yelled.
"We don't know that the dragon caused that fire, or that Gobineau is idiot enough to go chasing after such a monster."
"Please yourself," Brunner called back to Olgrin. "But I think Ithilwale may be right. I think Gobineau did call that thing to Mousillon, and I'm betting 2,000 in gold that where the brute is, Gobineau won't be far away." Without any further word, the bounty hunter turned and continued to ride eastward, his pack horse trailing behind. Ithilwale indulged in a smug smile thrown in Olgrin's direction before riding forward to join Brunner.
2,000 gold, the dwarf grumbled. "That bastard forgets that 1,000 of those are mine."
Olgrin dug his heels into his mule, urging the animal to keep up with the others. Night found the hunters encamped within the ruins of an old farmhouse. It seemed that the caprices of storm and snow had doomed the structure rather than the ire of a giant fire-breathing reptile, and it had been many seasons since anything larger than a squirrel had called the roofless remains home. It made a decent enough shelter, providing defensible barriers should trouble present itself. The lands of Bretonnia were not without their predators. It was not unknown for wolves to become famished enough to try their paw at human prey, and the grey wildcat of central Bretonnia, a beast almost as large as a small stag, was well known for a taste for horseflesh. And, of course, there was always the threat of human predators. The knights of Bretonnia were not so widespread and all-powerful as to completely eradicate the bandits and highwaymen common to other, less chivalrous lands. Ithilwale turned away from her contemplation of the darkening landscape. To her elven eyes, the starlight served her almost as well as the sun, allowing her to watch the owl as it swooped down upon the field mouse, to observe the fox as it silently padded along a rocky outcrop. Only to the northeast was her vision obscured, denied by the thick blackness that told her they were nearing the carnage she had spotted many hours before. The warm breeze that picked at her garments and rustled through her hair carried with it the faint suggestion of the same acrid musk they had smelled about the ruins of Merriman's fortress, the sickly stink of a dragon. The elf shuddered. The beast was near, so very near that she could almost imagine its eyes watching her from the darkness, its ancient, evil soul contemplating her with a cold, unfathomable regard. She had listened well to those terrified wretches, they had come upon during their exodus from Mucilon, and she had shared in that terror. They had good reason to know fear, for Ithilwael knew the name of the beast Gobbino had aroused, and knew its awful history. Ithilwael turned back to the camp, stepping back toward the campfires Brunner and Olgrin had set. The dwarf was crouched beside his flame, roasting a skinned squirrel. The dwarf had set his own camp at the far end of the ruin, as far from Brunner and Ithilwael as he could manage, even keeping his mule with him, as though it might become infected were it to linger near the elf's mare. Olgrin looked up from his cooking, a fell look in his eyes.
"You can catch your own, tall ear."
Olgrin spat.
"This one's mine."
"I had thought it little improvement on your looks after you cleaned yourself," Ithilwael retorted. "But at least you might have cleaned your mouth when you bathed everything else." The elf's words brought a fresh stream of half-articulate invective from the dwarf. Ithilwael did not linger to wait for Olgrin to run out of curses, but strode instead toward the other campfire. Brunner was seated before the fire, still garbed in his shabby brigantine armor. His helmet and weapons lay nearby, arranged about a makeshift bed of blankets and saddlebags the bounty hunter had created for himself. Only the slender length of the sword, Drake's Malice, was still with the warrior, resting across his knees as he stared into the fire. Ithilwael stopped, fascinated for a moment by the harsh shadows the flickering flames threw upon the killer's weathered features. There was something painful about that face, something that seemed to call out to her. Such pain, such unspoken suffering. She could see it there, crushed beneath the scowling turn of his mouth, the jagged scars that creased his cheek and forehead. It was there in his eyes, frozen within the chill that had consumed the man's soul. Something terrible had happened to this one, something that had devoured his world, taken from him everything that had made his life worth living, and in one final cruelty denied him the sanctity of a decent death, abandoning him to a ghostly existence among the shadows and the darkness. Perhaps only Ithilwael had ever seen such things in the cold eyes of the killer, the piteous, forlorn remains of a once glorious civilization. The piteous tragedy that fed the bounty hunter. For his were eyes not unlike those of her own people, a phantom race lingering among the forlorn remains of a once glorious civilization whose hour of glory had passed. "What do you see in the flames?" Ithilwael dared to ask. The bounty hunter did not look up at her as he replied.
"Things that never were," Brunner told her.
His eyes rose to meet her own, the tragedy subdued once more, overcome by the fire of hate.
"Things that will yet be."
Ithilwael stepped closer, letting herself sink gracefully to the ground beside Brunner.
"There is a fable among my people that if one looks too long into a night fire, one sees one's own death in the flames," she told him.
The bounty hunter shook his head, a grim smile on his face.
"I see the death of other men, not my own," Brunner stated. "But death is too little to take from the man I see in the flames. He owes me much more."
The bounty hunter's hand clenched into a fist, and his voice dropped into a low whisper.
"From him I will take everything."
"Those who give their lives to revenge are ultimately consumed by it," the elf cautioned. "I have seen what becomes of those who give themselves to their hatred. They are grim, wraith-like creatures, never knowing the solace of a soft touch or the warmth of a loving voice. You remind me of them, the lost people of Nagarive."
Ithilwill shook her head sadly.
We call them Shadow Warriors, but not because they dwell in the shadowy canyons of their broken homeland, nor because they strike their hated folk from the cover of darkness. No, we call them shadows because that is all they are. They are not whole, for all the light and love has gone out of them, leaving behind only the hate. Only the thirst for vengeance.
Sometimes, the bounty hunter cautioned, hatred is all the gods care to leave us with. Man and elf were silent for a long time then, each staring into the flames, as though mesmerized by the dancing tongues of fire. It was Ithilwill who at last tired of the sight, turning her back to the fire with a shudder. The bounty hunter reached out to her, placing his hand on her shoulder.
I know who he is.
Ithilwill spoke, her voice hollow, as though she were gripped by fatigue. Indeed, Brunner said. Jean-Pierre Gobineau, worth 2,000 gold crowns, less 500 crowns, if he is brought back dead.
Not the rogue, Ithilwill said. The dragon. The beast the grave robbers in Musilon described. It is known to me.
The elf saw now that she had Brunner's complete interest, the bounty hunter's eyes gleaming with curiosity.
The blackened neck upon a body of crimson scales, the jagged scar running along its belly. Such were the marks spoken of long ago by the refugees who left these lands when the eastern colonies were abandoned. They spoke of a great dragon, a horrible beast that brought fire and death upon those trying to make their way to the sea, hunting them as a wolf hunts a flock of sheep.
Ithilwill paused, recalling the horrifying first-hand accounts she had read in the libraries of Safari.
I cannot doubt that this man's foolishness has brought the same beast back into the world, the one they call Malok the Destroyer.
After centuries of slumber, within the fiery heart of Laila de Sangre, the dragon Malok was two things, angry and hungry. The merciless destruction of Duke Merriman's castle in Musilon had temporarily sated the former of those two qualities, but the expenditure of energy and effort had fanned the fires of the second. The dull pang of appetite that had been clawing at the back of the dragon's mind had become a desperate need, pulling him away from the prospect of laying waste to the already desolate city in order to silence the protests of its belly. In the pre-dawn that glowed above Bretonnia, Malok's crimson scales seemed to catch flame, glowing like smoldering embers amid the ashes of an expired flame. The early rising peasants, slinking through the waning darkness in order to tend their fields and herds, looked up in horror at the spectral visitation, their shrill cries of fright warning the countryside that a monster was abroad. For his part, the dragon paid the shouting, fleeing wretches little mind. He could crush them easily, but there was little meat on a man. Malok was interested in something that could satisfy his hunger, not simply tease it. The dragon had stirred often enough through the long centuries since the rise of the kingdoms of men to know that where men were to be found, so too would be more satisfactory prey animals. After only a few moments since first sighting the fleeing peasants, Malok spied what he was looking for, his belly grumbling in anticipation. The dragon was not concerned that a large herd of cattle being led to pasture belonged to the Marquis du Valier, nor that his herds produced the finest bulls in Bordeaux, and had done so for nearly 1,000 years. He was not concerned with the men who tended the herds, loyal yeomen whose families had served that of the Marquis for centuries, and to whom the care of the prized herds was something dearer to them than their own households. All the dragon saw was meat, and that was enough.
Like a thunderbolt hurled by an angry storm god, Malok descended, jaws agape in a roar that could shake the roots of a mountain. Fire and smoke flaring from his nostrils, black wings spread like the grim shroud of Mor himself. The terrified herdsmen stared at the mammoth shape of the dragon. Faces turning pallid, mouths dropping open in horror. The herds around them began lowing in fright, as soon as the acrid stink of the worm offended their noses, arousing ancient fears. To their credit, the herdsmen tried to contain the fright of the cattle, even as they fought against the terror gnawing at their own hearts. But it was like trying to stand against a stormy tide. The huge herd of the Marquis de Valier began to stampede, smashing the herdsmen beneath their hooves as they fled before the dragon. Malok watched the herd stampede, swooping down low to intercept the cattle, to change their direction. Occasionally, the dragon would cast a quick gout of fire from his fanged jaws when the looming shadow of his form alone was not enough to turn the cattle, the fire repelling the bullocks instantly. There was a box canyon ahead, nestled between a cluster of small hills. The dragon was guiding his prey toward the natural bowl-like depression. It would take more than a single bullock, more than a dozen, to fill the dragon's belly. The reptile intended to gorge himself on the entire herd. The leading cattle encountered the stone wall of the canyon, as the weight and momentum of those running behind bowled into them. Slavishly following the example of the animals before them, the stampede continued to back itself into the canyon, filling the declivity with a solid mass of lowing, frightened beef. Even as the rearmost animals began to turn around to escape the trap into which they had fled, the enormous shape of Malok dove upon the entrance of the canyon, like a lion pouncing upon a jackal. The dragon's gigantic bulk and evil scent turned the cattle yet again, crashing backwards into one another in their fruitless quest for another way out. Malok watched the animals for a moment, then drew his head back, allowing the fires within him to build and gather. For several days now, the peasantry of Bordeaux had been reporting that a dragon was despoiling the dukedom, slaughtering entire villages and laying waste to crops and fields. Such reports had traveled far, taking a life on their own, the awful aspect of the creature growing with each retelling, the record of atrocities laid at its feet increasing with every league the stories traveled. The lords of Brittany understood their humble people, knowing that they were a superstitious and simple folk, given to flights of fancy and populating their imaginings with all manner of dread beings. But they also knew that for such stories to have become so widespread, that there must be some grain of truth behind them. Though no dragon worthy of the name had been seen in Brittany for centuries, such creatures had once been a common enough menace before their breed was all but exterminated by the valiant knights who bent their knee before the king and lady. Was it possible that one such monster had perhaps escaped the fate that had befallen its kin? The very possibility ignited the ambitions of young knights wherever the story spread. It was not long before isolated bands of bold knights-errant, eager to earn their name, and stalwart knights of the realm, intent of proving their mettle against the beast of legend, found themselves on the ill-tended roads of Bordeaux, journeying toward the lands from whence the tales had originated. Among these knights was one who had taken up the quest, searching up the holy chalice of the lady. When first he heard of the dragon, Sir Falkirk knew that this was the mighty quest the lady had set him, the task he must undertake to prove himself worthy of drinking from the grail. As Sir Falkirk rode southward toward the region where it was said the dragon could be found, he encountered the small bands of knights who were likewise intent on smiting the worm. Once again, inspiration took its hold upon Sir Fulcric, and as he encountered these small bands of dragon slayers, he invited them to make their journey with him. Fulcric knew that it was just possible that he might prove unworthy, that it might be the beast and not himself to emerge triumphant in their contest. If such were to come to pass, it must fall to another to end the monster's rampage. Many of the knights he encountered agreed with Fulcric's point of view, understanding that more than their own honor and prestige, the death of the dragon must be achieved for the good of the land. It was decided that they would take turns in attempting to smite the vile beast, the most valiant and noble of their company being allowed to make the first attack upon the monster. If that worthy should fall, then the next most heroic of their gathering should be allowed the chance of avenging his fallen companion and vanquishing the horrible monster. Sir Fulcric's squire took down the names of each knight who joined the ever-growing company, recording their deeds and honors, and ranking them by those accomplishments, determining their place in the roster that would challenge what they had taken to calling the Beast of Bordeaux. As a knight who had taken up the quest, and as the warrior who had organized the growing crusade, Sir Fulcric humbly allowed his own name to appear at the top of the list. By the time the force of knights and their attendants reached the burned-out cinders of a small village on the road to Mousillon, they numbered over 100 men, including knights from as far away as Aquitaine and Lyonnais. Early in the morning hours, as the knights began to stir from the tented pavilions their servants had erected some small distance from the ashes of the village, the sharp-eyed squire of a knight from Gisoreau announced that there was smoke on the horizon. Thick and black, rolling like some seaborne tempest, it was clear to every man in the company that what they saw was no simple peasant cook-fire. The call to arms was shouted, and squires hastened to help their masters into their gleaming suits of steel plate and colorful tabards. War horses were dressed and armored, lances and swords sharpened in anticipation of the coming battle. It was little different from the eve of war, save that the light of ambition shone a bit more clearly in the eyes of each knight. The armored warriors spurred away from their camp at speed, leaving their retainers and many of their squires behind. The pillar of black smoke danced and writhed in the sky before them, as though calling out to them, beckoning them. At the fore of the knights, Sir Fulcric murmured a prayer to the lady that his heart would be true, that his courage would strengthen his arm, that his sword would strike cleanly. There was no question of the beast's doom, not with so great a company riding forth to smite him. Even if the dragon were able to slay some of them, each knight would take his toll on the monster. Once, a visiting dignitary from Estelia had described the bullfights of his homeland, how the fighters would attack the bull in waves, each man not seeking to kill the powerful animal, only to injure it and draw off more of its strength. Until the time came when the matador would step forward to finish the animal. The dragon could fare no better than the bull, not with so many knights opposing it. For much of the morning they rode. Fulcric had to curb the eagerness that filled each knight's breast, that they might not fatigue their horses before they drew within sight of their quarry. It was nearing noon when the knights finally reached the source of the smoke. They reined in their horses at the base of a hill, beyond which the thick clouds boiled. Clearly the dragon had set fire to whatever lay beyond the hill, indulging its malevolent desire for wanton destruction and wickedness. The horses shied, clearly disliking the smell of the smoke, though the only odor the knights could detect was that of cooked beef. Fulcric, however, was inclined to trust the instincts of his charger. The smell of dragon was said to upset animals, and if that was the case, then the reptile might be near. Sir Fulcric called out to his squire, who dutifully rode forward. The knight ordered his servant to read out the roster, that all in the company might know their position and take up his place should his turn arise. The squire had called out only a dozen names when the horses began to whinny in fright. Now there was no mistaking the thick, acrid stink, the reptilian musk of a great worm, overpowering even the reek of 300 charred cattle. The knights, almost to a man, looked away from the squire's recitation, lifting their eyes to stare at the top of the hill. Ahead, slowly rose above the brambles and stones, an enormous wedge-shaped head coated in scales of crimson. The knights stared in awe at the sight, for it was as large as a carriage, and the blackened object hanging from its jaws was, they realized, the entire carcass of a full-grown bullock. For a long moment, the dragon did not move, gazing off into the distance, its head framed by the black smoke billowing behind him. Then the monster's gaze shifted, its yellow, snake-like eyes transfixing the warriors arrayed at the base of the hill. The mammoth jaws opened, freeing the carcass to tumble down the face of the hill. A roar, like the splitting of the earth itself, bellowed from the dragon's maw, a shriek that rippled across the valley. Sir Fulcric looked upon the awful sight, dumbfounded by the enormity of it. It was bigger than anything he'd ever seen, bigger than even the largest river barge or merchant ship he'd ever heard of, if the rest of the creature's titanic size matched that of its head. The idea of a single man trying his sword against such a beast seemed utter lunacy. He looked aside at the knights around him. He could feel their pride and courage withering beneath the dragon's gaze, and could almost see their noble hearts shuddering beneath their breastplates of steel. Nor was he alone in their imaginings. After its first wrathful stare, the dragon uttered a low snort of contempt. Then the awful countenance withdrew behind the hill once more. Fulcric fought to steady his steed as he drew his sword. If he did not act now, then the entire company might break apart, scattering as their fear devoured their honor. This, then, was why the lady had led him here. Not to slay this terrible creature on his own, but to lead those worthy and valiant warriors in ridding the kingdom of this rampaging horror. This was his test, and Fulcric was determined that he would be worthy of it. The knight raised his sword high above his head, lifting his voice in a great shout that drew the attention of his fellows, even those struggling to maintain control of their steeds. In a voice filled with the courage that had led him to victory in battle against the beastmen of Chalon and mercenary soldiers in the hinterlands of Caron, Fulcric called upon the other knights not to allow their fear to unman them, not to cast aside their honor in the face of some malevolent beast. He extolled them to place their hearts and their faith in the lady, to trust in her grace to see them through this mighty deed. Many of them might perish in the coming battle, but it was the manner of a knight's death that was the final testament to the worthiness of his name. And what more noble death could there be than sparing their beloved kingdom from the rapacious pillaging of this monster? There was no cheer of approval, no mighty shout of support for Fulcric's impassioned words. But, as the knight turned his horse about, facing the mouth of the little valley behind the hill, the little canyon that was now choked with a virtual wall of smoke, he found that he was not alone. To a man, the other knights reined their horses beside him, lances at the ready. There was no longer any thought of personal honor or prestige. This battle would be one they would share, one that would be fought for the glory of Bretonnia, not that of one man. Fulcric held up his hand and looked over at his waiting squire.
"Take this list back with you," he told his servant.
Let them know who it was that fought here this day. Let them know that in the hour of its need, the knights of Bretonia did not abandon their people and their land." Falkirk concluded his speech by dropping his hand, leading the charge into the thick black smoke. His squire lingered until the last knight had disappeared into the valley, then turned away, riding with all haste back to their camp. The squire's list would be used to inscribe the memorial that would stand for centuries at the mouth of the canyon. Beneath it, there was a grave, a single grave for Sir Falkirk and his knights, for the identities of the ash and heat-twisted suits of mail that were recovered from the valley could not be told. As one, they had charged into the valley to face the dragon, and as one, they had died. As one, they had died, and as one, they were entombed. In pace requiescat. From the top of a small hillock, a group of men watched the smoke billowing in the distance. As they looked on, an enormous shape of crimson and black emerged from the smoke, its leathery wings beating the air with powerful strokes. Beneath the awful shape, a trio of mounted figures rode madly away from the mouth of a narrow canyon. Even from so great a distance, the shine of sunlight upon the armor that clothed the riders announced to the observers that the horsemen were knights. The huge dragon circled above the racing steeds, then, like some fiery comet, came hurtling down upon the earth. Like a hawk falling upon a hare, the immense reptile struck one of the riders, crushing both man and horse into the ground beneath its own tremendous bulk. The other riders did not spare a backward glance at their slain comrade, but spurred their own animals to greater effort. The dragon simply remained as it was, one claw poised above the mashed ruin of the rider it had struck down. It seemed the other knights had been granted a reprieve, as the monster made no effort to lift itself back into the air. Then the dragon's head reared back like a coiling serpent. Flame and fire exploded from the dragon's jaws, engulfing the two riders as they tried to escape, igniting the hair, cloth, and even skin of the stricken men and beasts. The knights fell from their chargers, boiled within their suits of steel plate. The chargers themselves continued to run like living torches that were soon lost behind a tangle of brush and trees. Even from their vantage point, miles in the distance, the watchers could hear the mighty roar of triumph the dragon sent lashing at the heavens. It was a sound to make even the most valiant of men shake and tremble. For the less stalwart hearts that had sworn their services to the Viscount Augustine de Chesgnay, the terror was even more profound. Only one man among the small group of watchers seemed undisturbed by what they had seen. Indeed, upon the black-cloaked man's cruel face, an avaricious smile had formed, and a greedy light had entered his eyes. Rudel, renegade wizard of the Celestial Order, pointed a claw-like hand to the spectacle unfolding in the distance.
"Look upon it, fierce wind! Look upon that magnificent brute!" Rudel cackled. "What may stand before the might of such a monster?"
The man to whom the wizard spoke was a huge figure, easily towering above Rudel and a dozen men-at-arms who stood nearby. Sir Fierswind wore a suit of plate armor, much like that favored by the now vanquished men who had fallen prey to the dragon's ire. His helm, which he held beneath his arm, bore the likeness of a bull, great horns spreading out from either side. Normally, the dark-colored tabard of the Chesgnay would have been worn over his armor, but the Viscount had called for discretion in this matter, and anything that would boldly proclaim the identity of his servants was to be avoided. The knight had served his master long enough to know the danger of disobeying his wishes, even if they chafed at what remained of the knight's pride. Fierce Wind, harsh, almost brutish features, did not display the same enthusiasm as the wizard. And it was with great unease that the warrior at last spoke.
"You told his lordship that you could control this monster,"
the knight reminded Rudel.
"But how is any man able to do such a thing?"
Once more, Fierce Wind's eyes strayed to the gigantic reptile, now picking bits of bone and flesh from between its talons. Rudel laughed, a harsh and mocking sound.
"When I have the fell fang back in my possession, even that fearsome beast will be nothing more than a slave, a faithful dog to obey my every command. Think of it, Fierce Wind, that mighty beast descending from the midnight sky to burn down the homes of my enemies, to grind their bones into dust beneath his claws."
"You mean his lordship's enemies,"
Fierce Wind warned, reminding the wizard of his loyalty. The knight's hand was closed around the hilt of his sword. Rudel carefully considered the knight and his blade, then nodded his head in apology.
Of course, the wishes of the master come first," Rudel said,
his voice absent of the enthusiasm it had shown only a few minutes before.
"I fear that I let my excitement overcome me. Please accept my humble apologies."
Fierce Wind continued to regard the wizard dubiously, his hand still closed upon the hilt of his sword. He did not trust Rudel, nor did the Viscount. The wizard needed their help, it seemed, in obtaining this artifact. But once it was secured, perhaps he would have no further need of the oath of service he had taken. De Chesgnais had warned his knight to take no chances with the dangerous sorcerer, to strike fast and true at the first sign of treachery. A master of betrayal and subterfuge himself, the Viscount had an uncanny knack for sensing duplicity in others. As if sensing the turn in Sir Fierce-Wind's thoughts, Rudolph's face darkened and his voice became stern.
"I would not use that sword, Fierce-Wind," he cautioned. "Only I can sense the guise I placed upon the fell fang. Only I can lead you to it. Your master will not thank you for denying him such a weapon."
Rudel smiled as Fierce Wind released his hold on the sword.
"A very wise decision," the wizard told him.
He turned, staring off into the distance.
"The man we are hunting is near now, but moving again."
He pointed with a clawed hand, indicating the south.
"Let us hasten to relieve him of this burden he carries. Then we shall gain all that we desire."
The handsome bandit was feeling a bit more himself now that he had put the cursed city of Mousillon and the dungeons of his former patron, the Duke Marimond, behind him. With most of the city cringing within their hovels in the aftermath of the dragon's attack, leaving Mousillon had been relatively easy. Just the same, he had paid a quick visit on Jacques, the old brigand who had led him to Marimond's castle, ensuring that he was not unduly harassed by the impoverished and desperate rabble dwelling in the streets. Perhaps Jacques had not known how Marimond's feelings toward Gobineau had changed. Perhaps his old friend really hadn't understood what he was leading the outlaw into. Still, Gobineau did not believe in letting any debts pass uncollected, and besides which, he'd needed some decent clothes and some traveling money after his stay in Merriman's dungeons. Jacques certainly wouldn't be needing them any longer. Gobineau watched impassively as the rather plain-looking serving wench brought a plate of mutton to his table. The inn prospered chiefly because of its location near the hunting grounds of no less than 3 local lords, and after a hard day of hounding boars and chasing stags, the knights were often of a mind to stop at the inn and sample its cellar. Fortunately, Gobineau saw no evidence that any of Bretonia's chivalrous defenders were about this evening. If the rumors he'd heard were to be believed,
They were probably out chasing after his dragon. After what he'd seen in Mousillon, Gobineau didn't think anyone would be hearing from any knight who found what he was looking for ever again. The maid set the steaming mutton down before Gobineau, batting her doe-like eyes at him as she did so. The outlaw looked up at her, sucking at his teeth as he considered her charms. Not much to work with, he decided. His stay in Merriman's dungeon hadn't been long enough to lower his personal standards quite so much. He waved the woman away, paying her reluctant retreat little mind as he prepared to attack his meal with his knife.
Ranald's cloak!
The thief cursed as he hastily withdrew the mutton from his mouth. He glared at a serving wench who was now timidly returning to his table, drawn by his outburst. With a violent motion, Gobineau hurled the plate at her.
I said I wanted this cooked, the outlaw roared. This is as cold as an eel.
The serving maid knelt, retrieving the spilled mutton from the floor.
But it was cooked,
she protested, cowed by the anger in the outlaw's voice.
Any longer in the flame and it would have burned. Then burn it,
Gobineau snarled back.
You mud-grubbing peasants might be used to eating your victuals raw, but I am accustomed to finer things.
He gestured at a girl with the point of his knife.
Now take that back to the kitchen, and see that it is prepared properly this time.
Gobineau let his furious eyes linger on the woman until she had retreated back through the door that led to the kitchens. Then turned his gaze on the few other patrons, scattered about the inn's common room, daring any of them to take issue with his harsh tones. Not a one cared to match the outlaw's eyes. Gobineau turned his attention back toward the tankard of ale sitting on the table before him, one hand reaching up to scratch at his shoulder. Whatever cinder had struck him had certainly done its wicked work well. Examining it after liberating a horse from a peasant farmer a few miles outside Mousillon, the rogue had found his shoulder to be raw and red, as though someone had placed a hot iron there. The skin had peeled away, and what lay beneath was wrinkled and slick with pus. Gobineau supposed that it was worry over this ailment that made him so irritable. There were enough diseases running rampant through Mousillon to make an ordained healer from the Temple of Shalia shudder. The bandit desperately hoped that he had not contracted one of those. A loud, bellowing voice, thundering from the entrance of the inn, snapped Gobineau from his worried thoughts, causing the thief's sword to leap into his hand, even as he dropped into a crouch that placed the bulk of the table between himself and the doorway.
Jean-Pierre Gobineau!
The voice roared. The rogue relaxed slightly as he saw the man who shouted his name. He was a tall, muscular brute with a full black beard where it was not interrupted by the criminal brand that graced his left cheek. The bearded man strode across the inn as though he owned the place, his face showing that he took a great deal of amusement in Gobineau's reaction. The outlaw slowly rose, but kept his sword drawn. "Hubolt!" the rogue greeted the newcomer, keeping his voice level and without either enthusiasm or hostility.
"I should have known that ugly face would have been sitting in a basket by now."
"Not for the lack of trying on part of the king's men."
Hubolt grinned back.
"I'd have imagined you knifed by some woman's outraged husband."
"I still might if old friends see fit to shout my name across public places,"
Gobineau retorted acidly. Hubolt laughed at the outlaw's comment.
"Oh, you don't have to worry about that here,"
the bearded man assured him.
"Not with this rabble. They wouldn't dare tell someone about one of Hubolt, the black's friends, staring here."
The big man paused, directing his gaze at the low-born patrons of the inn.
"They wouldn't dare,"
he repeated in a deep growl. Those who had been observing the exchange between the two rogues hastily looked away, finding the wood grain of their tabletops of much greater interest. "Still playing the brigand?" Gobineau inquired casually as he resumed his seat. Hubolt retrieved a chair from another table and sat down beside the other outlaw.
"Aye, and a bit of poaching as well," Hubolt said. "Still a fair bit of money to be made smuggling things into Musilon, too, if you have the nerve and the contacts."
There was a suggestive spark in the brigand's voice, one that Gobineau readily interpreted.
"Not for me, thanks," the rogue replied. "In fact, I've just come from there. I think I've seen enough of Musilon to last me a lifetime."
"Driven off by this dragon everyone is talking about, eh?" Hubolt laughed. "They say it burned down half of Musilon. Every knight from here to Kennel seems to have taken it into his head to ride off and kill it."
The brigand laughed again.
"Ah, well, while the cat's away chasing shadows, the rats have free run of the mill."
"What if this dragon was more than a mere shadow?" Gobineau said.
Hubolt smiled back at him as though waiting for the gist of the jest. Gobineau allowed the brigand several moments to wait. An idea was forming in the rogue's mind, a scheme so audacious it was worthy only of a man of his own boldness and cunning. But he might need to take on a few partners to make it work. Hubolt had been a tractable enough fellow in the old days, neither stupid enough to endanger his fellow rogues, nor clever enough to worry about him usurping Gobineau's schemes for his own.
"Bah,"
the brigand scoffed, taking a deep swallow of the ale in Gobineau's tankard.
"I've never seen a dragon, nor met anyone who wasn't a liar who had."
"I have seen it,"
Gobineau stated, staring hard at Hubolt, daring the larger man to call him a liar.
"I watched it smash Duke Merriman's castle into dust."
Hubolt was silent for a long moment, digesting this information.
"Then the knights will be coming back soon,"
the brigand grumbled.
"Seems the good times are going to be short."
"The good times are only beginning,"
Gobineau contradicted him.
"Any knight that goes looking for that monster is only going to find his own death. I've seen it, seen what it can do. The only way these men are coming back is in caskets."
A sly grin manifested itself on Gobineau's face.
"These are times made for men bold enough to take what they want."
Hubolt nodded his head.
"I can't say I'd miss the knights, but I also can't say I believe in this knight-slayer of yours. There may have been dragons before, there may even be one now, but in every legend I've ever heard, it's always been the dragon that came out worst."
Gobineau reclaimed his tankard, taking another sip of the ale.
"If you'd seen what I have seen, you'd know that there is a great discrepancy between legend and fact."
A cunning light gleamed in the outlaw's eyes.
"But let us tarry in the land of legend for a moment. What if I told you that there was a way to call this dragon? A way to make it do what you wanted?"
Hubolt laughed again, grabbing back the tankard.
"I'd say you've been drinking something a lot stronger than this swine piss."
Gobineau smiled back. That was the reaction he'd expected to hear.
"Ah, but there are some people who might not find the possibility so funny,"
the outlaw stated.
"They take it very seriously indeed. Might do anything to keep a bad man from whistling for his dragon. They might pay anything, too."
Suddenly, Hubolt's face was entirely serious.
"You're saying a clever man might use this dragon to line his own pockets?"
The brigand rubbed his hairy chin as he considered the prospect. Gobineau leaned forward, lowering his voice into a conspiratorial whisper.
We tell them that if they don't pay us, we'll call the dragon down on them, burn their crops and their homes and their plump little children.
But what do we do if they don't pay?
The brigand pointed out.
They'll need some convincing.
Why, we call up the dragon and burn their village,
Gobineau said.
Then the next village will require less convincing.
Call up the dragon,
Hubold snickered.
I like that, Gobineau. Of course, you mean that you have me and my boys set a few fires in the middle of the night, eh? Burn them out while everybody is sleeping and leave none to tell the tale.
Something like that, yes.
Gobineau grinned back. He looked away from Hubold, watching as the serving wench emerged from the kitchens with another platter of mutton.
Sounds like a fine scheme,
Hubold agreed, especially with all the knights busy chasing after their own tails. Might make a tidy profit before folks get wise. The brigand gave a sour look to the servant girl as she set the plate down before Gobineau and hastily retreated.
Where do we start?
He asked, returning his attention to the outlaw.
I was thinking we might start in Canal,
Gobineau told him, eliciting a boisterous laugh from Hubold, as the brigand imagined the preposterous magnitude of working such a deception upon an entire city. Gobineau left him to his laughter, attacking the blackened mutton with his knife. Once again, he spat the meat from his mouth.
May the dark gods rot your cook's soul!
The rogue snarled. He rose to his feet, impaling the larger portion of the mutton on the length of the sword blade. Hubold watched in perplexity as Gobineau strode to the roaring fireplace that rested against one wall of the room. The rogue thrust his sword into the fire, letting the flames crackle and claw at the mutton. For long minutes, he concentrated upon the task, ignoring the whisperings and mutterings his actions evoked from the peasants watching him. At length, Gobineau retrieved his blade and marched with it back to the table, sliding a blackened chunk of charred ash onto his plate. Hubold watched in morbid fascination as his friend began to eat the almost cremated mutton.
It's so hard to find people who know how to prepare food properly these days,
Gobineau complained between crunching mouthfuls of charred meat.